voice the prophets heard. He is a God that we should know, who speaks from his inspired word.
There is a God.
There is a God.
He is alive.
He is alive.
In him we live.
In him we live.
And we survive.
And we survive. Come thou star God.
Come thou star God.
Created man.
Created man.
He is a God. Set men free, and evermore with him could live.
There is a God.
There is a God.
He is alive.
He is alive.
In him we live.
In him we live.
And we survive.
And we survive. Come
thou star
God.
Come thou star God.
Created man.
Created man.
He is our God.
He is our God.
The great I am.
Welcome to another lesson from the Bible presented by the Hamilton Church of Christ. In 1 Peter 1, verses 24 and 25, for all flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man is the flower of grass. The grass withereth, and the flower thereof falleth away, but the word of the Lord endureth forever. And this is the word which by the gospel is preached unto you. So we see here that our bodies are going to pass away someday, and they're going to wither away and no longer be. But if we can have the word of the Lord in us, then we will know how we can live so that we can endure forever just as the word does. We invite you to join us in our study today.
I'm in the way, the bright and shining way. I'm in the glory land way. Telling the world that Jesus saved today. Yes, I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. Heaven is nearer and the way groweth clearer for. I'm in the glory land way. Onward I go, rejoicing in his love. I'm in the glory land way. Soon I shall see him in that home above. Oh, I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. Heaven is nearer and the way groweth clearer for. I'm in the glory land way.
As we continue our study in the book of Genesis, we're now in the 34th chapter, ready to begin to 23rd verse. The setting for this passage is that Jacob and his large family are now living at Shechem, which is on the Canaan side of the Jordan River. They've been here for about 10 years or so. The children have grown up to the extent that the sons are now in their 20s. Some of them are. The older ones, such as Simon and Levi. And Dinah, the youngest and only girl in this large family of boys, is in her teens at least now. And she wanted to have some other companionship her own age, and the only girls around would be the girls in Shechem, these high-back girls, and so evidently she was allowed to have some company with them. Well, while this was happening, she had sexual relations with Shechem. The Bible says he lay with her. How willing Dinah was for this to happen, we're not told. But in her young age, she could have had some rebellion and actually been rebelling against some of the teaching of her parents and gone too far and let this happen, or it might have been something that was more or less forced on her by Shechem, But this was certainly a sin, but it was one that was very acceptable in the city of Shechem. This seemed to be quite a common occurrence among these idolatrous Hivites, and the fact that it happened didn't seem to disturb them very much. But Shechem also stated that he loved Dinah. He wanted to marry Dinah. He went to his father and asked him to see about arranging for a wedding. His father's name was Hamor. And so Hamor promptly went over to Dinah's father, Jacob, and started making the proposition to let the two marry and let these two groups, these Shechemites and Israelites, get together. And you take our daughters and we take your daughters, and we can join our two groups together here and have economic gain as well. Now, about this time, the two brothers, Simon and Levi, came in and heard what was being said, and they were very upset about this matter. They were upset to the point that they were ready to kill somebody. And so they devised a deceptive plan where they said, okay, we'll do this. We'll get the two groups together. You can have Dinah for Shechem. And in order to do this, though, we have a religious rule where we have to be circumcised. And so we require that all your males be circumcised for this plan to be able to be brought about. And so Hamor and his son Shechem bought this idea. And they, verse 20 says, Hamor and Shechem, his son, came unto the gate of their city and communed with the men of their city, saying, these men are peaceful with us, therefore let us dwell in the land and trade therein. For the land, behold, it is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only herein will the men consent unto this, for to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. So verse 23 says, and this is where we begin our lesson today, shall not their cattle and their substance and every beast of theirs be ours? Only let us consent unto them, and they will dwell with us. And unto Hamor and to Shechem, his sons, hearken all that went out of the gate of his city, and every male was circumcised, all that went out of the gate of his city. So they bought the plan, the whole city agreed to do this, and they're all the males going to be circumcised. But while we're reading about the plan that the sons had, and the idea that this was accepted by the men of Shechem, the Bible is very silent here concerning the question which we should all be asking as to what Jacob thought about this arrangement. Jacob certainly would not have approved of this plan, that of uniting the people of Shechem with his own family, because he well knew that God had called them to be a separate people. Neither could he have approved the plan of Simon and Levi, because he later bitterly rebuked them when he learned what they had done. We must assume that he was not involved in the making of these plans, and that he may not have even known about these plans. In his grief and his uncertainty as to what to do at this time, and his depression that he felt after what had happened to his daughter, he evidently had just kind of backed out of the responsibility that he should have been taking as a father, and he was leaving everything else to the sons. At this point, he no doubt immediately didn't know what to do. Like any other father in this circumstance, just what do you do about this? How do you undo this? How do you change this? And so while he was in this state of depression and uncertainty and kind of being withdrawn even from the negotiations, these plans were brought about. And Jacob probably didn't dream that they'd come up with any kind of a plan like this, a plan that would involve the murder of people and so forth. And so we see that this was actually a great mistake on his part, that Simon and Levi took full advantage of their father's weakness at this time. They should not have moved in like they did and taken over. And Jacob, of course, shouldn't have let them do this, but they caught Jacob at a very weak moment. Any of us might have a weak moment in these circumstances. And Jacob must simply have isolated himself until he later learned about the terrible act of vengeance that was carried out and actually saw that his sons had done it. It also seems a little odd that neither Reuben nor Judah took part in this affair. Reuben, especially as Dinah's oldest brother, should have taken charge if Jacob didn't. But later developments show that both Reuben and Judah were much less disposed toward bloodshed than the rest of their brothers. In the case of Joseph, they did not want to put Joseph to death. And it may very well be that they backed off after they saw what Simon and Levi were really planning, though they didn't do anything to prevent them from carrying out this strategy. There is, of course, the possibility that they were simply away at the time, and probably Jacob's other sons were still too young to take an active part in this plot. In any case, Simon and Levi took the lead, and Jacob really wasn't involved in this. And Simon and Levi had some real reason for their indignation. Of course, their sisters had been very badly corrupted by this Shechemite. And then the very idea of proposing that he could pay them a dowry and let him marry her. And then the further proposal that they would let the Israelites unite with the idolatrous people of Shechem and all become one group and lose the identity of the Israelites and actually corrupt their reason for being separate for as God's people. They were right in thinking about those things, but they were utterly wrong in taking the law in their own hands in such a cruel way. God would one day have to judge these Canaanites for just such sins as this. And as we learned earlier, he said the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full. That is, it wasn't time for this land to be judged yet. That was going to come 400 years later. It wasn't the time for it now. And of course, they probably didn't realize all that. They should have been willing to leave the matter to their father's disposition of it. Let their father deal with this. Let's let some time pass here. Let's get all the heads together on this. And then Jacob, in turn, should have relied on God for proper wisdom in dealing with this. Jacob should turn to God for guidance in this matter. But Jacob, in his grief, had really not faced the problem at this time, and Simon and Levi felt they could not leave the crime unpunished. So the two brothers decided that nothing but the death of all the men of the city could atone for such a crime. But the two of them, even if aided by such servants as they might be able to have to help them, would not be a match for the much larger number of Shechemites. They probably realized, too, that they could not merely slay Shechem and himself and get away with that, as his fellow townsmen would immediately come after them and probably kill all the Israelites. They could see no solution but to get the entire city so incapacitated by having them all submit to circumcision that they would be unable to defend themselves. Even though this involved a blasphemous corruption of the holy meaning of circumcision, they carried out this deceptive plan, and they were very successful by doing so. So let us read what actually happened in verses 25 through 29. And it came to pass on the third day, when they were sore, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword, and came upon the city boldly, and slew all the males. And they slew Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah out of Shechem's house, and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain, and spoiled the city, because they had defiled their sister. They took their sheep, and their oxen, and their asses, and that which was in the city, and that which was in the field, and all their wealth, and all their little ones, and their wives took they captive, and spoiled even all that was in the house. Simon and Levi had much experience with circumcision, having been something they knew about all of their life, and they knew well that the painful and crippling effect of the circumcision surgery was greatest on the third day. On that day, the two brothers, probably assisted by their servants, proceeded boldly into the city, going from one house to the next, putting every male to the sword until they had slain them all. When they came to the house of Shechem, they killed him also, and took Dinah out of his house back home with them. After the deed was done, perhaps assisted now by some of Jacob's other sons, they took all the women and children captive, probably making slaves out of them. They also took all the animals of the Shechemites, plus all their other possessions. In effect, Simon and Levi had waged a two-man war against the city of Shechem and had come out completely victorious. In their own estimation, at least, they were victorious. Perhaps they even considered their victory to be evidence that God had his blessing on them with this plan, and their cruelty actually was, in their mind, simply holy zeal in defending their faith from corruption by pagan idolaters. They were young men, not yet seasoned in judgment, and they had surely been grievously provoked by what they considered to be the actual rape of their sister, and they were also greatly provoked by the indifference that the Shechemites themselves had toward this crime. Had Shechem been arrested by the law and charged with the crime here and had to stand some kind of a trial and go through punishment, That might have made things much different, but that's not the way it was. The Shechemites looked upon this action as a perfectly acceptable thing to do. As we said before, this is a sad commentary on our society today, which in many instances would take this very same attitude that the Shechemites had for a situation that had happened to Dinah. And as they were much upset about this, this still cannot justify their blasphemous treachery and murder. It is clear that much of the real blame here must lie with Jacob. Not only had he, who had once been so strong in the Lord, allowed the conditions to develop in his household that which would lead to such things, but when the crisis came and serious decisions had to be made, he was not there to make those decisions. He somehow or other had refused to face the problem until it was too late. Now we must have some sympathy with Jacob here though, because being the father of Dinah, this was certainly a blow to him to learn what had happened. This was something he had to take a little time to try to recover from and to even get some kind of thought as to what should be done. But nevertheless, this was the problem. It may be that he didn't even know about his son's actions until he saw them bringing back their captives and the spoils from the Shechemite houses and fields. Dinah was also back home now. No doubt she was in a state of mind approaching shock from what she'd seen and experienced. Whether she willingly went through this or not with Shechem doesn't really change the fact that all the deaths and murders and pillage that occurred because of her action here. And if she'd done it unwillingly, and it truly was a rape, then this would even more of a shock to her. And if she had rebelled against her family, now she still had to face Jacob and Leah with this result of her rebellion. And Jacob himself must have been aghast with the enormity of what had happened so suddenly to disrupt the peace of his life and that of his family. Everything now had been completely upside down. Nothing was the same anymore. It wasn't the same. His dealings with the Shechemites were not the same. Shechem had been decimated. And so we can see then what one action of a child doing things that they shouldn't be done or have things done to them which should not be done to them can completely upset the harmony and peace of a family. And this is an upset that's not easy to get over. So in verses 30 and 31, "And Jacob said to Simon and Levi, You have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. And they said, Should he deal with our sister as with a harlot? When Jacob finally did try to gain some control again here, when he did start to take charge, it was merely to complain to Levi and Simon about what they'd done. There wasn't much he could do to undo this, that's for sure. He'd left the matter in their hands, whether he intended to or not, that's the way it turned out. And now he was mortified at what they had done. He tried to live peacefully with the Shechemites, perhaps even hoping that his altar and the testimony that he and his family had borne to them would influence them someday to follow Jehovah. But now, whatever testimony his family might have had was gone. Whatever example they might have set for this community was no longer there. Instead of being a witness for truth and love, their name would be associated with deception and cruelty. They had become an actual stench to the other Canaanites in the land, with their vaunted moral purity becoming an excuse for murder and pillage rather than to set an example of God's holiness and mercy. Furthermore, Jacob continued, that they were now vastly outnumbered in the land, and when the news of this massacre circulated among the other Canaanite tribes in the region, it'd not be long before they would all converge on Jacob and destroy him and his whole family. They didn't have a chance now among this nation of foreign people. God had delivered them from Laban and Esau. Each of them had only small bands of followers, and at that time Jacob's cause was right. But how could they expect divine protection from the great host of ungodly Canaanites surrounding them when they themselves were in the wrong? Jacob's complaint was silenced, however, by one question from Simon and Levi. He was complaining about the action they had taken, but what had he done? Had he forgotten that his daughter had been raped by the very prince of the city of Shechem, and that to add insult to injury, his father Hamor had actually sought to purchase Dinah as though she were nothing but a harlot. And then they had dared to propose to unite with the Israelites in one great mixed multitude, which would inevitably have destroyed them and their high calling so that they would no longer even exist as a family. Was all of this of no concern to Jacob? If he had known of a better way of dealing with the problem, why had he not said so? Where was he? Where was Israel, the strong prince who had power with God when action was actually needed? And of course, this was a question that Jacob could really say nothing to. He didn't have a reply for this. He had indeed failed. And now he was in desperate need of revival in his own soul, as well as of a fresh word of guidance from the Lord. So we can see how badly Jacob must have felt. Not only had he felt initially this failure because Dinah had had this happen to her. Dinah was in the house of the Shechemite and had sexual relations, and he was now wanting to marry her. This would give any parent a sense of desperation and feeling like he'd failed. But then to have these other events happen after that, and he had just completely lost control of the situation, would give him a double sense of failure, because these sons that had done this were, after all, his sons. They were part of his family, and he had some responsibility for them, he must have felt. And though the scripture does not say so, it seems most likely that Jacob did now go to his altar and there cry to God for forgiveness and instruction. And God, who is gracious and long-suffering, answered him once again. And of course, this is exactly what each of us need to do when we have similar situations. Maybe it will not be ever as drastic as this was with Jacob. We hope not. But still, situations like this can happen. And we may have a son or a daughter who gets into an illicit sexual relationship, who maybe even gets into a marriage that they shouldn't have gotten into, maybe have children out of wedlock, maybe get into the taking of dope or alcohol or run with crowds that do such things as that, and have just completely ignored the Lord. And our time then is to take a stand, to be strong, to turn to God, and to continue to do those things that we know that are right. That's the stand for us to take. It's the stand for Jacob to take. And it's very likely that Jacob had been too long at Shechem, that God had not really intended that he stay there, but that it had been a convenient place to settle. Being in such close proximity to the Shechemites would naturally tend to have certain of their influences to infiltrate his family so that they would begin to have some turning away from the true God toward these things of the Shechemites. And also Laban's idolatry had some remnants left among the people, in that his wife, Rachel, had taken two of his images, remember. And so all of these things could have a deteriorating influence on the high and holy status that his family needed to have. And Jacob had simply failed to deal decisively with these corrupting tendencies in his own household, and now had come to this. He may have even been a bit smug and confident in his own spirituality, as he'd seen God's great power exercised so frequently on his behalf, and he felt that he and his family were more secure than they really were in such an ungodly land. Now, you know, we today can have this very same thing happen to us. We can know that we are Christians, that we're living right, that we're doing what the Bible says, and we can begin to ignore little things that creep in. We begin to not really see the dangers of the influences of those outside our family, and we can allow ourselves to actually be gotten into a weakened state before we even realize it. And here we've done nothing. So Jacob was now in critical need of a fresh revelation of God and his holy purposes for him. Now we leave chapter 34 of Genesis and we're ready to begin chapter 35. The first verse of chapter 35 says, "And God said unto Jacob, Arise and go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God that appearedest unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother." It was at this very critical point in Jacob's life that God once again spoke to him. This time he's speaking to him in a graceful way rather than in a judgmental way. Jacob was truly at a low point here. He'd had some really difficult things happened to him, and the answers weren't real clear as to what to do. And it's possible that in Jacob's grief over what had happened in these past few days had led him to go to God in confession and prayer. It led him to turn to God in a close way, seeking wisdom for the future and forgiveness for his negligence during the 10 years he spent at Shechem. When God answered him, he answered him to instruct him to move away from Shechem and to go up to Bethel, which was about 15 miles south of Shechem, but it was 1,000 feet higher in elevation. For some strange reason, though Bethel must have had some uniquely powerful memories for Jacob, it was there that God had first spoken to him from the top of the heavenly ladder when he fled from Esau, back in Genesis 28:12-15, and though he lived so close to it for about 10 years, he'd evidently never returned to it again. And this is very strange in view of the fact that Bethel was located that close to Shechem. Maybe that he had delayed at Shechem so long now that he realized he was a little bit out of step with what God wanted him to do, and so he deliberately avoided going to Bethel. That's something we don't know for sure. But at this point, we must close our lesson. At next lesson, we will begin at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.
In the way, the bright and shining way, I'm in the glory land way, telling the world that Jesus saves today. Yes, I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. Heaven is nearer and the way groweth clearer, for I'm in the glory land way. Onward I go, rejoicing in His love. I'm in the glory land way. Soon I shall see Him in that home above. Oh, I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. Heaven is nearer and the way groweth clearer, for I'm in the glory land way.